People come to us and multiple try to get in, so we should just confess. So, as usual, that sometimes that when we are meditating, our kids feel as well, and sometimes little kids can be noisy. But you always have, never allow the noise to disturb you. It's only you who disturb the noise. It's fine if the kid there who wants your attention. You can cuddle them or just talk gently to them, being in the present moment of time. And it's also that sometimes the child can actually pick up on the energy of the mum or the dad. And even just being in them here is wonderful because it soothes, they calm down. Just simply because everyone else is calming down here. Not perfectly calm, because life is never perfectly calm. And if it's not your kid, it's not your responsibility. In our busy world, I always ask people to maybe imagine a bubble around them. Just imagine a bubble like a little cave around you. And what's outside is not your problem at all. So you can actually come inside, you hear the sounds, you don't disturb them and react to them. It's a way of learning how to be peaceful and calm wherever you are. I have sometimes meditated in some of the noisiest places in the world. I remember meditating once in the airport in Thailand, the new airport, Sawanabum, in the middle of the concourse, sitting down there waiting for somebody else to arrive for an international conference for 1 hour. And as I was meditating there, it was just so busy, so noisy, what I decided to do, imagine a big bubble around me. When I had this big bubble around me, I was like in a cave. You could hear noise outside, but you didn't allow it to come in. In other words, you weren't disturbed. And even years ago in the Burmese community, were having problems with, in the time of Aung San Suu Kyi being in house arrest, and many good monks just walking down the streets being shot at by the military like that. And just to bring some awareness there, the Burmese community asked, were just holding not a protest, but a very silent vigil in the middle of Perth. And now, monks don't protest, we give outside of politics. But if it was just a silent vigil, I thought, I also wanted to test myself, because it was right in the middle, on the steps of a church, and opposite, this very busy part, with lots of noise being blasted out constantly. And I thought, can you do that, sitting without any cushions on the cold pavement for 2 hours? And just allow the noise to disappear. I remember just doing that, I was very happy that you could, in the most noisiest of places, get very still and very peaceful. That takes lots of training. And that's for most people, at home, in what they call the real world, where you have kids. So how do you deal with kids when you want to meditate, young children? Or if you are a kid yourself with noisy brothers and sisters. So this story was told to me by this Australian girl, young mother, two kids, boy and a girl. And she always wanted to meditate, but as soon as she started to close her eyes to get some peace in her house, in her mind, her kids would ask her, "Mummy, mummy, I need to go to the toilet." She never needed to go for it, she wanted attention from mummy. "Mummy, mummy, I need a glass of water. Mummy, mummy." And when she didn't respond, when she had her eyes closed meditating, they were crying all over her. She had long hair and started pulling her hair. Money, 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 money. And what... there we go. And then she got so frustrated she could never find time to meditate that one day she just sat there. Mummy, 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 need to go toilet, need to go potty. Mummy, 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 I need some water. Mummy, mummy. That never worked. Then they tried the pulling hair. She never responded. And then never doubt the ingenuity of young kids. Mummy, 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 Barry has got the kitchen knife out from the drawer. Barry, Barry, Sarah has turned on the gas. Mummy, mummy, mummy. And she thought, no, I'm going to meditate and I don't care if the house blows up or if they mutilate each other with a kitchen knife. I'm going to meditate this time. And she did that. She just meditated. As soon as things went very quiet, and she had her little meditation time. And when she opened her eyes, the house was still there. So the place hadn't blown up. And the two children were sitting quietly. They hadn't taken the knife out and cut each other to bits. This was just threats to get mother's attention. And she said from that day on, she could always find her time to meditate. When? So she closed her eyes. The kids knew there was nothing they could do for she to get the mummy out of her meditation. She won her meditation time, she earned it. And after a few times, the children realized that mummy or daddy is a much better mummy or daddy after they've been to the temple to meditate. That's why, so often in the regular meditation talks which I've given, sometimes you see mothers, fathers come to the temple to meditate and they say, I never wanted to come to the meditation tonight. I came back from work and I was tired, exhausted. And my little four-year-old said, Mummy, are you going to meditation tonight? I said, no, darling, I'm too tired. Mummy, I think you should go to meditation tonight. No, I'm exhausted. Mummy, go to meditation tonight. Why? Because you're a much nicer mummy once you come back from meditation. Is that true, kids?
No.
Yeah. So sometimes we do this. The wisdom that it makes you a better person. Less stressed out. What is one of the biggest problems in today's world? Stress. And unfortunately, that comes even at a very young age. Maybe when I was a kid here in London, you'd go out, you'd play soccer all the time, you'd do lots and lots of free time. The homework wasn't that much. The exams, well, they were pretty easy, but there wasn't that much stress when I grew up. I don't know what about you when you were growing up in Sri Lanka or whatever. But now, poor kids, so much is expected of them. To the point that I was shocked when I was conducting a seminar over in Malaysia for Buddhist children between the ages of, I think, 14 and 22 or something. And just asking the children, this was maybe 10 years ago now, what is your biggest difficulty in your life? And they replied, the biggest difficulty was stress, tiredness, exhaustion. So my goodness, 14-year-olds being exhausted at that age, that's not setting a good example, you know, for their future. So learning how to relax more does actually help you overcome that tiredness and anxiety, even at such an early age, to the point that I was fortunate that even the first meditation teacher I found could teach me how to relax and be peaceful. And even to the point that when I was at Cambridge University, big university, very posh university, but there we had what we call the final exams. And they were called final exams because or your degree or your lack of degree would depend upon just that one series of exams, the finals. Everything else you've done throughout the whole 3 years at university counted for nothing at all. The final exams were it, so the pressure was on. And I remember seeing the scrawl, this graffiti on the walls. Had very great, brilliant graffiti on the walls of those days, like sayings. And the saying I remember there was, exams kill by degrees. The tests. You were judged at such an early age. But fortunately, by that time I already knew how to calm my mind down. So this was exam in theoretical physics, quantum theory, astrophysics of the galaxy, really interesting stuff, but very tough. So in those days, the final examinations were held over 6 days, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and even Saturday. 3 hour paper in the morning, hour lunch, a 3 hour exam in the afternoon, one after the other. These days we call it human rights abuse, torturing your brain. Imagine that stress, hardly any break. One exam after another, after another, after another, 6 days straight. But by that time I already knew the basics of meditation. Peace as a means of relaxation. So what happened after a 3 hour exam on Einstein's general theory of relativity. After things like that, you have an hour for lunch before fundamental particle physics paper. Interesting stuff when you have to do an exam on it. And your future is supposed to depend upon this. The pressure was on. I often tell people, if only I had known I was going to become a monk for the rest of my life, I wouldn't have worried so much. The pressure would not be on. But I never knew that at the time. So what I did, I had a big breakfast, a nice dinner in the evening, I wasn't a monk at the time, and for lunch, I never had anything to eat at lunchtime, except I went back to my room, sat on a cushion and meditated for half an hour. And this is what happened every lunchtime. First of all, you sat down comfortably, and what came into your mind first of all? The morning exam I just completed. The pass. It was important. Did I do well? Did I answer the questions correctly? Could I have added something extra to my explanations? I started worrying about an important exam I just completed. And of course we all know that the exam paper was already in, it cannot be changed. You did a right answer or a wrong answer, too late to change. And why worry about things which you cannot change? When you look at it reasonably, logically, why do you worry about the past? It's finished, it's gone, unchangeable. But how many people can actually do that? How many people look back upon the past and say, well, if I did something else, if I answered this way instead of that way, the past cannot be changed, and so don't if the past. If I did this, if I did that, if I did something else, you don't know what would happen. There is a word in English used for in religion, spirituality, called ineffable. Like, there's many things like nirvana, ineffable, cannot be really understood, people say anyway. For me, ineffable is a word which has no meaning. It means that, you know, you cannot really understand it, beyond comprehension. But what's the point of that word? So I said I've used that word by changing one letter, ineffable. The past is ineffable. If you haven't taken that course, you've taken another course. If you haven't married that man, but married another man, what would it be like? Who knows, it might have been much worse. And you might say, no, it couldn't have been worse. Yes, it could. So don't if the past. So which means that for that morning examination, didn't really matter, it had gone. I cannot worry about it or be concerned about it. Because if I spend time, too much time, thinking about if I got the answer right or wrong, what might happen, I wouldn't be able to prepare for the afternoon exam, which was coming soon. So I can let go of the past. Now the next thought which came up in my mind was the afternoon test. Should I pick up the books and go and do some more revision? I had done that in the past. But you will find if you're having a test, if you pick up a book half an hour before the test, what you look at never ever comes up in the exam. So instead of worrying about the future, I learned how to prepare for the future by relaxing in the moment. I could let go of the future. So much stuff we worry about in the future. Are you worried about Brexit? What might happen? I'll tell you now that if Brexit does happen, then Britain will become Buddhist. You know why? I told a few people this joke. If Brexit happens, Britain will become an island unto itself. You remember that saying of the Buddha? Be an island unto oneself. That's a deeper. So, there's always look at things in a positive way. If Brexit happens, you'll be an island unto yourselves. Anyway, I thought that was funny. You see, there's young kids, they get jokes easily. And when I was talking to a neuroscientist, they were actually telling me that being able to laugh and see the funny side of a thing is actually a sign of high, high development of the brain. Have you ever seen people who don't laugh? The only people I've ever seen who never laugh are in a coffin. This is true. It's a sign of intellectual impairment or death. So that's one of the reasons why. You always see very highly educated people, very wise people, they can see the funny side of things. So, laughter, joy is part of our past. We'll come across that later on. For me anyway, letting go of the future, not worrying about it, again, worrying about things which you can't change. The future exam coming soon. If I get worrying about that, I become so tired and exhausted. So let go of the future exam, let go of the past exam. For me, that's coming into this present moment. Just like in the Bhavai Karate Sutras. In the present moment. And as soon as I became in the present moment, that is where I could get some very deep insights. Into, first of all, my body. I never ever thought of myself as a nervous person with anxiety. But now I was in a high stress position, situation, facing what I thought was my future in my success or failure in this exam. I was physically shaking. I never saw that before because I never expected it. I never thought of myself as being nervous. But when I looked at myself, I was physically shaking because of the stress of a final exam, which I thought was important. As soon as you see that anxiety in your body, it's so easy to relax it. And from that, later on in my life, I adapted that to physical health. The things like cancer. Cancers don't just come out of the blue. They develop. And if human beings were only more aware of their own body, they could actually feel there's something going on in that body, something wrong, something unbalanced. You can feel it in your body. And once you can feel it in your own body, you can do something about it. I have a very strong, I do a lot of work for even our cancer societies in Perth. So much so that it was some years ago that the government in Western Australia put a huge amount, multi-million dollar complex, you know, for people with cancer. So you have breast cancer, melanomas, prostate cancer, all the cancers. People could go to this one facility that had all sorts of treatments, counseling, psychologists. And when they had the main opening with the head of the government of Western Australia, they invited me as the other VIP. So they two or five VIPs came to the opening of this multi-million dollar centre. And of course I asked, why me? Why not an archbishop or an imam or anyone else? Why me? And they said, because many of the teachings which I've given over those years have really helped get people through their cancers. Of course I was asking why. What sort of insight have I given to have like healthy bodies? And this was one of that little body scan, being aware of your own body. If you're too busy worrying about what you're doing next, have to be aware of what's happening in your body right now. So little things which I learned in that present moment of awareness, I learned just how to relax my body. Starting at that examination where you're very shaky, I said, once you realize what a problem is, it's very easy to find out how to relax it. What makes it worse? What makes it less? Worrying about the future made it much worse. Relaxing, being kind, and fear would get better. Trial and error gave me just how to relax my own body. And many years later, being a monk in the forest, actually in the cave where I live in Perth, in Bodhidharma Monastery, sometimes you know, we eat all sorts of food. I never cook the food. I don't know all the time what you're giving me to eat. And sometimes you get sick. This particular, we call it indigestion. It's an occupational hazard for a monk. Because, you know, we kind of give it. This is very special. I must have this. Now, Hondra, please eat this. It's special for you. Sometimes you don't know what people put into the food. Now, sometimes I've had some shellac and fish balls which have almost burnt my mouth with spillerings. The fish balls are so much chilly in it. Same as the Thais, they have the papaya salad. And my goodness, some of that is hot. So anyway, but sometimes in this particular case, I don't know what it was I ate, but I had food poisoning. You ever had food poisoning? That's really painful. And I was in my cave. We built a cave where I live in Perth, in Bodhinyana Monastery, just south of Perth. We built that so I could have some peace and quiet. It's got a double door, it's underground, it's full of rocks, you can't hear anything outside. And it also means they can't hear me inside when I'm dying. So, what happened? I had these cramps from food poisoning. The thing is, it's involuntary. You have these spasms which are really painful. Ah! Oh! That's what it's like. And I usually give this little anecdote in the middle of a talk when I feel that people are falling asleep. It's certainly like, wait at this time, that's what it was like. And so it was too far to the office to get a phone call. I mean, amongst our people, we don't have mobile phones. We're sometimes concerned to see people always on their mobile phones. I don't know in England now, because sometimes we have like words for like bricklayers, we call them brickies. Is that what you call bricklayers here? Brickies. Okay. And like tradespersons call them tradies. Yeah, people who join motorbike clubs call them bikies. So people who use phones all the lot, not too much, we call them phonies. Are you a phony?
No.
So anyway, I didn't have a mobile phone, so I couldn't call anybody up. It was too far away from an ambulance anyway, I'd be dead by the time they came. Please sir, your call is important to us. The first available operator will attend to your call. Do you have that in the National Health Service as well? Yeah, okay. Throughout the world. So anyway, there you're there, left your home, you don't need an ambulance when you know how to relax your own body. You feel the tightness in your guts, or wherever it was. You're kind to it. You learn how to relax the contractions, the agony. Every time one happened, I learned how just to relax it. The next contraction or irritation spasm was a little bit less. Only a tiny bit less. The next one, a tiny bit less. The next one, a tiny bit less. The next one, it took me 20 minutes. Maybe half an hour. And so the spasms of food poisoning were calmed down so much, there was no problem at all with my guts. It was back to normal. No agony, no indigestion. Everything has just calmed down completely. Half an hour is all it took. If I'd have called an ambulance, I'd have to go back again by the time they came, because there was no problem anymore. And it was amazing what you can do when you learn how to relax your own body. I was talking on the way here with one of my best friends. I'll go back to the Cambridge story later on. One of my best friends, who's actually the first Buddhist I ever met. When I went to, I was a Buddhist before, but sometimes I scold the London Buddhist Vihara, because they're one of the first Buddhist temples here in England. And that was my area. That's what came there. Chiswick, Acton, I grew up, Hammersmith, I went to school. And I never realised there was a Buddhist centre there. And if I'd have known I'd have been there every night. I was a really motivated Buddhist. But when I went to Cambridge, it was Buddhist Society of Cambridge University. I thought, wow, there's actually places I can go to be a Buddhist. I thought I was the only Buddhist in London at the time. None of my family were Buddhist. I don't think anyone in my family could even spell Buddhist. But anyway, when I went to Cambridge, I had this big society's fair, and there was a Buddhist Society at Cambridge University. I thought, wow, this is great. I can actually practice my religion in Cambridge. I went up to the counter. There was a young man at the counter, and I said, I want to join. Now, many of you know the Buddhist thing. I said, you don't have to join. You don't have to commit. You can actually just come and see. Try it out. See if you like it. He said, no, I'm a Buddhist. I'm a Buddhist. I want to join. He said, no, don't be so keen. No, we don't know converting people or looking for members. You just come and have a test it out first of all. See if you like it. And I was actually irritated. The joining fee for 1 year was £1. I got out of £1, slammed it on the table, join me up. So he had to take my £1 and join me up. He didn't realise my background. I was a very committed Buddhist even then. And that fellow turned out to be one of my best friends, Emeritus Professor Bernard Carr. Emeritus Professor of Theoretical Physics at Queen Mary University and a really close disciple of Stephen Hawking. And so it was wonderful that, you know, I had a background where people were Buddhists, top theoretical physicists. He was also, that's why we became really close friends. The other society which we joined was the Psychic Research Society. We literally went hunting ghosts. If we found out there was some report somewhere in the vicinity of a haunting, we'd be out there sometimes all night trying to find a ghost. We never ran away from ghosts. This was experiments, trying to find out, being open to some of the weird stuff in the universe. If you think like ghosts are weird, you go into quantum physics, quantum entanglement, all this stuff, that's really weird. It works. So anyway, he became a really, really close friend. And I remember going to this experiment in the Psychic Research Society demonstration where they had a student, it could even be a film, a recording, I can't remember, but I remember the experimenter put a student under hypnosis and had a long stick with a 4-inch nail on the end. And under hypnosis convinced this young man that the nail was red hot. It was only room temperature. And touched the nail on the student's arm. Ah! He shouted in pain. I could always understand that. But what surprised me was seeing a blister come up, a burn come up on his skin. Even though it was you could touch it on my skin and it wouldn't burn at all, it was just room temperature. But because he believed it was heated up to red hot and touched it, not only screamed, but a blister appeared on his skin. I thought that was weird at the time, but he saw it with your own eyes. The mind is a forerunner of all things. If it can create a blister, a wound, a trauma on the skin, why can't the mind heal a trauma? Why can't the mind shrink a tumor? Why can't it heal a food poisoning? And of course it can. You do that yourself. So, that's why I spent a lot of time going to Canterbury. The mind is the forerunner of all things, and you can see it create a blister. Why can't you see it calm and quell a tumor. Hurting this girl would mind, by me telling this little anecdote. So like a girl in Perth, about 12 years of age, she had some trouble with her spine. And found out that through the doctors doing CT scans, her spine was twisted, congenital deformation of the spine. And the physiotherapist had said the only way to make sure you don't end up in a wheelchair for the rest of your life is to wear this brace, this iron brace over the top half of your body. And this poor young girl, she was so positive, everything in her life was going well. And it not only was really uncomfortable, but also was going to open her up for a lot of criticism by her friends in school. Kids going through puberty, kids being compared to others. Even her friends would probably criticize her, iron woman, or cage girl, I don't know what they might call her. But anyone is different in the school, sometimes you always get teased. So her mother was really concerned at the fact that her positivity in her life, which was obvious, would be diminished by having to wear this half-body brace. And also really uncomfortable, not allow her to do many things which other kids could do. And so she asked, came to see me, really concerned, can you teach my kids some meditation or something to help her? And so I taught her the simple meditation, and not it's just getting to the breath, but getting what we call in meditation limiters, the lights which appear in the mind when your body really starts to become calm and your five senses start to diminish. The limiters. We're all taught about by the Buddha in the Upakalesa Sutta, the Majjhima Nikaya. And there, she was almost like a natural, because 3 or 4 weeks later, her mother came to see me, almost crying, because something had happened. You asked the girl, and she said, yeah, she was meditating, and she saw this beautiful blue light, classic limiter. Sign of the mind getting into deep meditation. And I don't know how she did this or why she did this, but she imagined a picture of a distorted spine in the middle of the limiter, as she'd seen it many times from the CT scan, the spine twisted. And inside that limiter, she just decided to straighten her spine. She did that. And the next couple of days, when she went to the physiotherapist to get her CT scan checked, her back check on the CT scan, the doctor, the specialist, said, we have to do this again, there must be something wrong, because the lower half of her spine is straightened. And of course, that was just impossible. But her mother showed me a copy on her iPhone of the new scan. You can see the first scan, it was twisted. The second scan, the lower half had been straightened. A wonderful thing that is. Just through some meditation, mind being the forerunner of all things, making the mind very peaceful, you can actually do stuff with your own body. Mind, the forerunner of all things, has got power. So sometimes that makes it really interesting. So for me, back to Cambridge, back to the final examinations, calming the physical body down, making it very still. And then I came to the last part of every lunchtime. What I came across was how tired my body was, how exhausted it was. We'd just done 3 hours of really full-on intense brain activity. Now, answering questions on these amazing deep subjects and under stress. And so after that, my brain was exhausted. This is like the stress, the tiredness which people feel in daily life. And some people come to my meditation retreats, over in the longer ones. The first thing they do is sleep. They are exhausted, as you are exhausted. You've got what psychologists call sleep deficit. Been working so hard, life is so stressful, that you need to catch up on that sleep. Your brain is tired. And I'm pretty convinced that much of our sicknesses in today's world, especially things like cancers, cardiac disease, anxieties, are because our body is exhausted and tired. And something's going to break. Appears as cancers and stuff. So anyway, feeling how tired my body was. Exhausted. Now, obviously, it's not my fault. It's just working too hard in the morning. Really going for it to make sure that I did the very best I could in that morning exam. You just have to know it, be mindful of it, aware of the tiredness in the body. And once you're aware of it, you learn how to increase the energy of your brain. And I do that, I'm pretty good at that now, by just making my mind really still. And then the energy comes back into your mind. You literally recharge your mind really quickly. Of being very still, really peaceful. And that's happened, I learned that when I was at Cambridge. After about 5 or 10 minutes of really being still, not thinking, not worrying, relaxing my mind. After I came out of meditation, it was like I had a strong cup of coffee. But not without the shaking. Energize your mindfulness. What I've called in many of the books I've written and other talks, power mindfulness. Sometimes even superpower mindfulness. But I say that not as an exaggeration. Sometimes some of the things you can do with a strong mind are huge. And so with the power mindfulness, I'm so relaxed. It was like I just woke up in the morning after a good night's sleep. And I went into the afternoon exam. And my friends told me this afterwards, after all the exams were finished. We met each other. And they said, you were the only one going into the afternoon examination with a smile on your face. We thought you were cheating. Everyone else was really tense when they were doing the exam. It was important to them. And they were just so relaxed. But I was smiling, and they thought, he must know the answers. He must have found out what the questions were, first of all, or something. It was not that at all. I was relaxed because I knew how to relax my body and relax my mind. A simple meditation technique. And you know that once I tried to make contact with, all over, with many different leaders of religions. I had one friend who came to our monastery, he was a rabbi. And he came a really nice friend, Moshe Bernstein. And you know, first of all, when he came with a bunch of school kids from a Jewish school to visit me, they were talking about, so, you know, here we believe in reincarnation. He said, we do too. Really? And when I saw one of the other rabbis, I said, oh, you know, you guys believe in reincarnation. He said, do we? I said, well, Rabbi Moshe told me you do. Yes, well, Rabbi Moshe is Rabbi Moshe. So he gets into trouble every time. So that's why I sort of like him. He thinks for himself and investigates for himself. But anyway, when Rabbi Moshe was the chaplain of the school, he invited me over to teach their kids about examination technique for their final, what's equivalent to their A-levels. So I went there, spent the afternoon teaching the kids about to do these exams, university entrance, about how to do examination technique by exactly how I taught you. Then go in the past, then go in the future. Being aware of your body. relaxing your body, then relaxing your mind. And then, about a month after a couple of weeks after the results were published, I got a letter from the principal. The principal said, "Thank you so much, Attenborough. We got the top score in the state from our end of year exams. Thank you so much." It worked. So I don't know why more people don't actually do this for children doing O levels and A levels. Especially if you're Buddhist kids. You can get an advantage. In this very competitive world, any sort of thing helps. Instead, what you do with your kids is send them to extra tuition. Stress them out even more. When you've got great resources here in this temple. So this is what we can do. Learning how to relax stress. Learning how to become even smarter. Learning how when you've got a cricket match or a football or a tennis match or you're running the 800 metres final in Olympic Games. You're not supposed to win. How you can take it to the next level. I'm not saying that meditation is about to be a high achiever. But that's one of the byproducts of this. You find that you get a lot of insight and understanding into much of how your body works and how your brain works and then how your mind works. So when we do have some peace, what would I call it, just to give it another name, the wisdom born of stillness. A lot of thinking. People think too much and see too little. Here we are, I'll give you an example. It's okay, this is just a visual aid. I get to do lots of interesting things as a monk. For example, 3 years ago, I think now, I was invited to South Korea, to the IT capital of South Korea, in Daejeon, to actually give the keynote address, not the Buddhist conference, but the World Computer Congress. Now, if you've seen me on an iPad, you know it takes such a long time for me to do an email. And I obviously often have to ask other monks to help out. I'm 68 now. I'm past it. It's not my generation to have to do emails and IT and internet. But nevertheless, I have to go up there after the dignitaries who was I think it was not the president of South Korea, but I think one of the ministers of South Korea. And then the president of the Computer Congress. And then me. And people were wondering, what is a monk doing at a World Computer Congress? What are you doing here? You're a monk. You're not a sort of an IT expert. That's an amazing expert. The head of IT security in Europe, in the European Union, and all these other executives from especially Samsung, and who else was over there? And Google, and all these IT gurus were there. And here was me, hardly knows how to use a computer. What are you doing here? And I said, when everybody thinks the same, no one thinks at all. If you really want to innovate, which is an important part of any corporation, which is an important part of any community, which is even an important part of Buddhism, keeping the traditions, but innovating in their presentation. Not changing the Dhamma, but changing the way it's expressed in our modern world. And so I held up a plastic bottle like this. And I asked people, what is this which I'm holding up? So I said, no, bottle. water, plastic, blow on the top, cylindrical. They gave all these descriptions until the members of the audience. They were very cooperative because these were people who weren't innovators and they wanted to find out what the heck I was talking about. Until they couldn't say anything else about this. They had exhausted all of their labels. Everything they'd been taught, everything they had learned, they completed. I said, great, now you're silent. You may be able to see something in this that I'm holding up which you've never seen before. Not the labels, but sometimes what this is, and maybe other uses for this. That is called innovation. From stillness, once your mind becomes still, silent, not giving things labels, that's where innovation starts. So many great discoveries came from when the mind was silent. Even one of these other fellows over in Cambridge, how Brian Josephson, you look him up on Wikipedia if you wish, Brian Josephson, Nobel Prize winner, in what's called the Josephson Junction, based on quantum tunneling, the basis for supercomputers. Where did he get the idea from? Meditation. It was the TM meditation at the time, the transcendental meditation. Of course, mind really still, and the idea popped up. We gave him a Nobel Prize. And remember, he had to fight for that for about 4 or 5 years against an American Nobel laureate who said, you're crazy, it can't work, you're wrong. But he knew he was right. Came from deep meditation, saw this happening, and eventually stood his ground. Experiments were made, and he was right. And the other Nobel laureate, had actually by that time had a second Nobel laureate, one of the few people who got 2 Nobel Prizes, that's pretty up there, and then this guy comes along and says, you're wrong. And Brian Josephson was right, he got the Nobel for Physics. The only Welsh person who got that Nobel Prize. But anyway, the point was, that's where the insight came from. Deep insight, different ways of doing things, from being peaceful. That's one of the reasons why, to find a peaceful life, a peaceful world, don't talk so much, don't think so much, don't argue. If you're arguing, you're not listening. Thinking while you're meditating, you're not listening to the truths of the Dhamma from the world, but listening to your own thoughts. You're either talking back at life, or you're letting life teach you from silence, from peace, from stillness. That's all. Any great wisdom the monks or the bhikkhunis have ever taught you always comes from silence. Not repeating what you've heard, but understanding it. Then you go deep inside, and from the silence, the peace, the wisdom comes. In all parts of the life. So anyway, that's how you find solutions to problems. Insights, which don't just apply to the fundamental truth of life, even like reincarnation itself. Do people believe? They don't believe in reincarnation, or they think about reincarnation or rebirth without knowing it. That's one of the reasons why a person experiences stillness opens up so many avenues for knowledge and insights and even success in our world. You want to know your body? You want to know your mind? Be still. Okay. So that's an hour's talk.